Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this September 2009 installment of Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening's diversion, Jim Campanella. I'm going to start off with a little story that sort of falls onto the cusp of science, insofar as it's about how scientists are viewed by the world. I have forever been horrified by how scientists are presented in movies and TV shows. You usually see a scientist who is either A, insane, B, a social outcast, or C, in need of massive infusions of money to continue his or her sadly ignored but potentially earth-shaking research. Or all three. Scientists are never presented as the average, everyday person that you see on the street. Yes, we are a sad bunch of social losers sometimes, although geologists usually throw one hell of a party, but we are really very normal. We are neither plotting the destruction of the human race, nor are we building death rays in our basements. We live quietly prosaic lives where our research is mostly ignored by much of the world, except other specialists who might appreciate its intricacies. I have a young nephew who has only seen scientists in televisions and movies, and so whenever he sees me, he expects me to be toting an anti-gravity device around with me, or at least a tube of Ebola. He was very disappointed to see an actual science lab, which did not have the dim X-file lighting or the bubbling tubes of unknown substances or electric arcs. Where am I going with this seemingly pointless line of blather? Well, I was actually pleased to see that scientists are treated by one group just like anyone else out there. And what is that group? Scam artists. Bear with me as I read you an edited special piece of spam email that I received a couple of weeks ago. Much too long to read the whole thing. Let me start off by saying that the email purports to be from Elsevier Publishing, and that's the largest publishing house of science journals in the world. Here it goes. Dear Professor, Elsevier Journals are headed by editors and an editorial board of members. The editors and editorial board is appointed by the publication committee of Elsevier Journals. Editors serve a 3-year term, and editorial board members also serve a 3-year term. Board members are chosen based on the journal's need for representation from a particular subject area in conjunction with the individual's commitment to maintaining high journal standards as illustrated in objective and prompt reviews. We are asking that you apply for a position on the Editorial Review Board for Molecular Biology. We have read and published many of your scientific works, and we feel that you would be an ideal candidate to be part of the Elsevier editorial team. The Elsevier Journal's editorial office policy requires each manuscript to be reviewed by individuals who are highly competent and recognized in the particular field of the submitted manuscript. The editorial office feels that you are highly qualified. In order to be assigned as part of the editorial board, we ask you to officially submit your qualifications along with a $100 registration fee. Your credentials will be screened by our present board. Individuals who are accepted as reviewers and editors will be paid $30 per page of edited and reviewed materials. We would appreciate if you contact us as soon as possible because we are updating our data sheets for reviewers and editors, which we want to upload to our website as soon as possible. Thank you for your cooperation. Please reply to board.elsevier@gmail.com. Best regards, Joachim Kuz, Chief Editor. Professor. Wow. I just finished a 50-page monster for an Elsevier journal, and I didn't get a dime for that. If I could get on that editorial board, I could get $1,500? For that kind of work? Wahoo, sign me up. Does that go for editorial revisions too? I could get that big paper into an endless series of revisions at $1,500 per round. There's a misplaced comma on page 14. I'm going to need to see a revision before I can recommend publication. Ka-ching. And if I'm running a bit short on cash, well then a few reviews of the form, quote, interesting paper, but I'd like to see the manuscript be, maybe 15 pages longer? That would just about help make the mortgage payments. Unfortunately, it is all a phishing scam, perpetrated specifically against scientists. I was able to tell this based on several points. First, the email address is bogus. Elsevier does not use Gmail for its official email addresses. I mean, that's just silly. I've written them. I know this for a fact. Second, there is no Joachim Kühs professor at any university in the world that I could find, Dutch or otherwise. Yes, it is a Dutch name. Nor is he listed as an editor of any type on the Elsevier website. Finally, there is no way that any scientific publishing company would pay $30 per page for just reviewing. It doesn't happen. I actually have colleagues and advisors who are actual real chief editors of various journals. They don't get any money for the honor of being editor-in-chief. Do you really think they're going to pay anyone for just reviewing? Remember that scientific publishing is only a money-making operation for the publishers, not on the scientist side of things. We do it for the love of science and to have our names stuck in those journals for the next several centuries, not for the money. You may think of me as a bit nuts, but I think it oddly gratifying that somebody out there thinks that a group that is overwhelmingly filled with PhDs is a target for this sort of scam. Somebody out there in the Silicon jungle of the internet actually thinks the scientists are normal and venal enough to act like the rest of the world. Makes you kind of proud. Chokes you up a bit, doesn't it? Ah, well. I don't want to make this show about my email, but I got something else in the mail about a week ago. I do get mail from listeners, though not very often, probably because people simply have trouble getting in touch with me. Tony was kind enough to forward this particular letter to me. Before I go on, it might be a good idea to actually give an email address that you can get in touch with me, so that if you have questions and are curious and maybe want them answered on the air, I'd be happy to do that. You can get in touch with me at campanella@uvulaaudio.com. That's campanella at uvulaaudio.com. Uvula Audio is all one word together, no dots in between it. Okay? So Tony was kind enough to forward this particular letter to me, and I thought it asked some interesting questions, so I decided I'd share it with the rest of the listeners. I will also share my answer. I figure that since I went through all the trouble to research an answer, I should probably get some mileage out of it. Here we go. Hi, Tony. It's J.J. Campanella's segment in Oral Delights, number 96, which I much enjoyed, particularly the part about the light-sensitive bacteria, that brings me to send you a message. Several questions occurred to me during his recounting of the restricted diet study on rhesus monkeys. I hope you don't mind passing them along to him. Years and years ago, when I first started seeing press about restricted diet postponing aging, I saw some articles about rats or mice where they reported that rats or mice in the restricted diet group had to be kept on antibiotics because of their tendency to catch infections because the restricted diet compromised their immune system. I haven't ever noticed another article since then mentioning antibiotics. So here's my first question for JJ. How many of the restricted diet studies have had to medicate their study group to mitigate infections? The other remark he made that went by in a flash was that there was some indication that immunosuppressive drugs might also postpone aging. This ties into my first question, in that is it possible that it's immunosuppression that's key here? In the immunosuppressive studies, did they have to do something to control infection in the study group? While we're at it, a restricted diet does suppress the immune system, doesn't it? I'm sure I've read that bike racers, who are always watching their weight as well as riding hard, have suppressed immune systems and have to be careful about colds. Is that a myth or what? Thanks again for a great show, and here's hoping JJ can help me out of my puzzled state. Marion Goldeen. I hope Marion doesn't mind my using her name. Since she hasn't emailed me back and I did tell her I was going to do this publicly, I assume she won't have a problem with it. Here's my answer. Hello, Marion. I checked the protocol of the article that I mentioned in August's podcast and a couple of earlier ones, and I have to tell you that nobody recently seems to be giving rats high doses of antibiotics. That evidence alone suggests that the low-caloric diet does not weaken the immune system to the point thought at one time. Offhand, that kind of makes sense. Remember, they are simply giving rats just enough nutrients to stay healthy, and that's the key. The researchers are giving them just enough to not get ill from some nutritional imbalance, so there seems little reason why there should be a pathological response. Mind you, given all that, it does not necessarily mean anything in terms of your question. Modern laboratory facilities and qualities of animal care are pretty close to sterile, They even have vets on constant call. If those mice were immunocompromised, it would not be clear unless they were tested for it. Lab rats and mice are genetically so inbred that they're not always the best examples of genetic health anyway. They are severely inbred so as to be genetically consistent from rat to rat and mouse to mouse as possible. Many strains are actually bred purposely to have compromised immune systems. That does not necessarily cause a problem under lab environments where the animals are kept in such clean states that they're unlikely to ever get ill. It's possible that some of the early experiments that you were referring to actually used rats that were already immunocompromised and that that state had little to do with the low caloric treatment regime. Unfortunately, without an actual reference, I can't go back and easily find the paper that you were talking about. Now, about the immunosuppressant drug seeming to have an effect on longevity, I see that as coincidence. I mean, certainly there have been hypotheses from several researchers who have suggested that many of our problems with aging stem from immune systems that become, well, hostile with time. But it seems counterintuitive to believe that shutting down the immune system will actually increase lifespan. I think most gerontologists agree that to age well, you need an intact and healthy immune system, something that older people usually do not have simply because they're aging. I don't agree that aging is brought about by some sort of autoimmune disorder that we all undergo, and there doesn't seem to be really a lot of evidence for that. In fact, a recent article by Dr. Seemon N. Mandani of the USDA Nutritional Immunology Laboratory and Dr. Gene Mayer of Tufts suggests just the opposite of what you've been led to believe by that old unnamed study. And the paper came out in the Journal of Gerontology in July 2009, and it is entitled, "Calorie Restriction Enhances T-Cell Mediated Immune Response in Adult Overweight Men and Women." And the gist of the article is this. They examine the effects of calorie restriction on T-cell function in 46 overweight human participants aged 20 to 42 years. After 6 months, in addition to the obvious weight loss that occurred, there was a clear increase in the activity of the T-cells based on a whole series of abstruse tests. Anyway, the conclusion was the caloric restriction was actually good for the immune system. Less recent research articles over the last several years indicate that protein and calorie restrictions without malnutrition actually improve immunity by protecting against hepatitis B virus and malarial infections, as well as delaying or preventing development of cancer and cancer metastases, in addition, of course, to the usual life extension. In short, it seems unlikely that caloric restrictions have a negative effect on the immune system. Whether this conclusion will change in the future isn't very clear right now, but at the moment, it's probably not something to worry about. Good luck in the future if you decide to go the hard route of calorie restriction to extend your life. Talk to a doctor first. It's not something that most people can just start doing on their own. Cheers, me. The last two stories of the night are about ants. Now, you may not think that ants are very interesting, but with the recent rise in the popularity of zombie movies, I think you'll find both of these stories fascinating. I have mentioned before in previous podcasts that ants communicate in a variety of manners, but probably the most common is by scent. There are scents for just about anything you can think of, from sex to smells that indicate rank. Recently, a new scent signal was added to that panoply, a scent to indicate that you are dead. If you're a dead ant with the correct scent, you are picked up by the worker ants and tossed onto the trash pile with the rest of the refuse. Dr. Donghuan Cho of the University of California published work in the Proceedings of the National Academy a couple of months ago that discusses this scent signal in Argentine ants. You do not want to be giving off that death signal while you are still alive, or you will be hauled off to the trash heap. What prevents awkward mistakes about who's really dead are two additional compounds also found on the covering of living ants. Cho says, quote, "These compounds temporarily inhibit responses to the death cues by signaling, 'Wait, I'm not dead yet,'" unquote. So not only are there dead signals, there are I'm alive signals. Cho dropped fresh and not quite so fresh ant corpses into a lab colony and found that the ants that had been dead for only about an hour triggered about the same strong urge to remove them as ants who had been dead for 24 hours. And Cho said that such a speedy response seemed awfully quick for the decomposition chemistry to actually be triggering disposal. So he and his colleagues experiment with the notion that instead there was some still alive cue that actually fades really fast. To test different chemical signals, they took advantage of the ant's natural tendency to retrieve young ants at the pupal stage that somehow end up outside the nest by wandering away. Pupae don't have the same surface chemistry as adults do, so the researchers doused them with a whole brew of various signals. The team also treated the pupae with two compounds found on living ants and freshly dead ants, but not found on dead ants an hour or more after they were dead. And those two compounds, dolichaldiol and iridomyrmecin, naturally dissipate quickly. When doused with these compounds, the pupa were ignored when they wandered away. They were neither disposed of nor promptly brought back to the nest, suggesting other adults treated them as if they were indeed living adult workers. What's the upshot of this? If you want to be ignored by ants, douse yourself with these compounds. I'll be curious what would happen to an ant who was a mutant and didn't make the compounds. Would they actually be treated as the living dead, literally ignored by everyone else in the colony? Something very strange to think about. The other ant story is kind of related to the old Robert Heinlein novel, The Puppet Masters, and also to the original Star Trek's Operation Annihilate episode, which I mentioned in last month's podcast. If you remember those two stories, they have one thing in common: alien invaders who could control minds. Well, there is such a thing that exists on Earth. It does have a bit of an ick factor, so try not to be too squeamish as you listen to this. Doctors Shelley Adamo of Dalhousie University in Halifax and David Hughes of Harvard, in the September issue of the Journal of the American Naturalist, report on a fungus that attacks living ants and apparently manipulates their behavior for its own benefit. When the fungus strikes, an infected ant is forced to climb a leaf that is not too far off the ground. He bites into the leaf and then dies there with his jaws locked into place. Experiments show that these low-hanging leaves give the fungus prime conditions for growing a spore-bearing spike out of the ant's neck. Yes, the ant is forced to climb to a place where the fungus can just kill it and use it to help its reproduction. The leaf biting has been known since the 1920s, but it wasn't until this paper that researchers were able to show that the poor ant is being controlled by the parasite. The researchers determined that the ants were specifically being moved up the side of the tree to an optimal height for fungal growth by the fungus itself. Neither the high canopy nor the base of the tree worked for fungal reproduction. It would only reproduce on leaves just above the tree base. A fibrous fungal spike grew out of the necks of ants there and bore a segmented red-orange lump that Hughes compares to a lopsided pineapple. Blah. Okay, that's even kind of grossing me out, so I'll drop this. I think you guys get the point. The researchers have no idea how the fungus is directing the ant to do anything. That seems to be a bit of a mystery. Other researchers are already arguing that the study has flaws in it because of a lack of good controls, but I think it supports its point pretty well, even if it does not put a nail in the coffin of the ants and the fungus. Well, I've talked and talked and talked, so that's all for me for now. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.